Good morning to you. My compliments for choosing to come to a lecture on a Sunday morning. I confess that if I weren't sitting here, it would be very difficult for me to do this. And I think the least that we could do was to tempt you with a little caviar for brunch. So welcome here during the second part of a trilogy, which, as you know, is devoted to Vasily Kandinsky. What is this noise that I hear from above? Can you see to just... right. Kandinsky is one of the few artists whose work is extensive enough and separable enough in its extensiveness to allow this kind of a presentation. Obviously, you could do it something like this with Picasso. You would have to have at least 7 or 8 separate exhibitions. You could do something like this with Dubuffet, who has very clearly segmented his work. But even so, there are few artists with whom you can say that from a given period up to a point he did such and such work, then a clear break, a new stylistic evolution, a clear break, and another one. Kandinsky has this quality, and so the trilogy originally conceived of, I hope, makes sense in this case. About 2 years ago then, less than 2 years ago, we presented Kandinsky in Munich. Kandinsky, who I will recall to you, was born in 1866 in an upper middle class Russian family, who was slow in developing as an artist, who, despite his very sensitive responses to the word, to tones, and of course to visual stimuli, took a long time to convince himself that art should be his vocation. He was, in fact, 30 years old when he abandoned his profession, law and economics, and took off from Moscow to Munich, the Bavarian capital, where he arrived as a student. And the previous exhibition, Kandinsky in Munich, therefore dealt with this period in which Kandinsky gradually transformed himself from a student to a teacher, and then on to a critic and commentator of the modern scene. We saw him becoming a leader in the developing intellectual milieu of the Bavarian capital, assuming presidencies of artist groups which he has in part created. We saw him writing important theoretical articles and the book on the spiritual in art, über das Geistige in der Kunst, which became a basic text in modern art. Most importantly, these 18 years that Kandinsky spent in Munich brought him to the point in which he evolved in his own painting from pictorial beginnings and a personal fauve-like attenuation, something that became known eventually as abstract or as non-objective painting. Picasso thus became the father figure for abstraction, for the style which ever since has had far-reaching consequences in 20th century art. It is difficult to say whether Kandinsky was the first abstractionist. How would we ever know? How would we know at which point a painting loses all remnants of common reality and translates itself into this language in which meaning is conveyed exclusively through formal terms. It's impossible to draw an exact dividing line, just as it is impossible to know whether among others who worked and thought at the same time in similar terms, some such transition had not taken place more or less at the same time. But in any case, Kandinsky did achieve all of this and was a potent agent in the cohesion of an intellectual environment when the First World War broke out, as you know, in 1914, forcing Kandinsky and others to disperse almost overnight and bringing to a close a episode in modern art from which we are still drawing strength today. And it is at this moment, ladies and gentlemen, that the present exhibition is beginning and at which I will comment in relation to the works on the wall now. Just see whether I can't get a little closer to you here. Do you hear me well? I don't know for whom the other chair was meant to, but Kandinsky, I this would make me very nervous. Well then, we are in the year of 1914. Kandinsky is no longer young. He arrived in Russia in 1896. As a 30-year-old, he spent 18 years in Bavaria, so that he is approaching his 50s as he is forced to leave overnight, for he is a Russian citizen, would be an enemy alien if he remained in Germany. So he and his friend and mistress, Gabriela Münter, leave Munich to go first to Switzerland, and then, with small pauses, travel crisscross throughout Europe, often to Russia. Russia begins to become his real home, even in those war years. Spent some time in Sweden, in Stockholm, active time with exhibitions, before the return to Russia is definite. Now, these were, of course, geographic dislocations, somewhat bothersome to a painter who cannot immediately continue to work wherever he is. There are relatively fewer works that Kandinsky did in this period. There are years in which not a single painting, at least there's one year in which no single painting was completed. Everything was done in small materials and works on paper, as you can see. When you begin the exhibition at the top ramp. These geographic dislocations were also accompanied by personal changes. Kandinsky and Gabriela Münter have been close for many years, but it was a difficult and taxing relationship, which obviously is coming to its end. In 1915, they meet, it seems, for the last time at Christmas in Stockholm, and the liaison ends at that point. Very shortly thereafter, within a year, Kandinsky meets a young woman less than half his age, the daughter of a Russian Tsarist colonel, Nina Andreevskaya, and in 1917 they marry. Together, they return to Moscow, where they settle as much as one can during the revolutionary years, during the very year of the Russian Revolution. Now, accompanying these geographic and personal changes are, of course, more fundamental ideological reorientations of a rather complex nature. Let me speak about it as follows. Art has no meaning if it is not closely related to life, to developments in a particular time, in a particular span during which thoughts and experiences assume different shapes. It would be too simple to say that art is a direct reflection of political events. It doesn't work quite this way. But art is nothing if not an expression of reality, if it is not a visible language of underlying currents. And so the changes that were at its most crude and brutal level indicated by the great first war in our century obviously brought with them, along with them, certain mental reorientations, certain changes in man's conception of himself and of the world around him. It is dangerous to simplify them too much, but it could, I think, be argued that the ideals of the 19th century, of the Victorian age, of Romanticism, have become so eroded as to, in fact, collapse. The faith of individuals in the dignity of man, in individual values, in the separate contribution of highly gifted people, gave way to a important degree to new assumptions, to a new faith in collective solutions, in a belief that the world's ills must be solved differently than through single and individual contributions, a switch from individuality to collectivity, and new ideals accompanying such switches were certainly in the air. In Kandinsky's case, there were very clear breaks with his own past. And as you begin this exhibition on the top, and if you compare those works with what you have seen in the Munich period, you see the beginning of the changes from what I would call expressionism to constructivism. Now, let me speak about these terms not in an art historical sense and not in the sense of prevailing professional expressions, but in their most fundamental and most basic meanings. Expressionism, broadly defined, is the exteriorization of inner values, the attempt to find signs, symbols for what goes on within you. It is, in the typical instance, an expression of great urgency, almost a painful process of bringing out what is within you. From Matthias Grünewald to Jackson Pollock, expressionists were those who felt compelled somehow to spill themselves into the materials that they used as artists. The direction was from within outward. And the art that resulted in this way tended to be urgent, fast, combining the elements that made it up. It is usually an art with fast lines, with strong colors, in which forms were melting into each other and gave expression to something that had to come out. Well, constructivism reverses the direction. And again, if you take this not merely art historically, but if you take it in general terms, from Piero della Francesca to Mondrian, then the constructivists are those who, finding things on the outside, finding forms, have great faith and belief into the power of these forms as indicators of an existing or an aspiring order. Constructivists, in other words, would tend to find an existing language or create an existing language through which they would indicate their aspirations. Aspirations for order, aspirations for clarity, aspirations for morality, the tensions that exist in order to arrive at these states of mind. And what is so interesting in the earliest part of this exhibition, let's say from 1915 to 1921, is this gradual change from expressionism to constructivism, is what we perceive as a tightening of Kandinsky's visual language. No longer does a painting fill the entire canvas. No longer does it spurt forth with seeming speed and spontaneity. On the contrary, there is the tendency to take the canvas, restrict the actions upon it, draw an edge around it, and within this edge, which acts almost like a stage, produce a controlled happening in which quasi-geometric forms begin to tell their own story. So, in those transitional years between Munich and his more regulated life in Moscow, the changes from individuality to collectivity, which were general, and the changes from expressionism to constructivism, which was also not limited to artists, to Kandinsky, but was the artistic response to these underlying changes, were the most visible aspects of Kandinsky's art. Now back for a moment to his life in Moscow, about which, incidentally, we know very little. The years in Russia are not well documented. There are fragments that are at our disposal from which we try to establish a clear notion of what Kandinsky was about, but we are much less sure of what happened roughly between 1917 and 1922. If you want to read about life in Moscow in the revolutionary years, I do not recommend any source close to Kandinsky, but I recommend to you to read or reread Pastianak's Dr. Zhivago, in which the particular area is beautifully, the particular era is beautifully described. Zhivago, incidentally, is an interesting fictional parallel to Kandinsky. Reading the book, I always felt that Dr. Zhivago, in his own way, was very much the kind of a person that Kandinsky was himself. Both were highly cultivated people, upper middle class individuals, who nevertheless had sympathy with the revolutionary thinking and its effects in Russia. They were both what you might call socialists by their own ideals and by their own inner tendencies. At the same time, they both found it difficult to remove themselves from the values and standards that directed their lives. In both instances, there was considerable repugnance to the simplistic aspects of communism. And both had, of course, ultimate faith and commitments in the dignity of man and in what we call humanism. So I could never read Pastianak's Zhivago without thinking of Kandinsky, and particularly of Kandinsky during those Russian years. He was by no means unknown by that time. His reputation preceded him, and he was by no means without interest to the cultural, bureaucratic, communistic system that began to emerge there. I might remind you that in the early years of Bolshevism, there was sort of a honeymoon between revolutionary politics and abstract art. The assumption was that these are parallel expressions of the same fundamental credo, and that they have a great deal to say to each other. And so Kandinsky was, in fact, appointed to some sort of a artistic commissariat in which, as far as I can tell, he was providing guidelines, aesthetic guidelines, in new institutions, in visual art institutions and cultural centers that were springing up all over Russia. The texts about Kandinsky frequently refer to the fact that he has created 22 new museums, any such preposterous figure, which for somebody who has tried to do one or two in one's lifetime, it makes it entirely implausible to accept. After all, he was there only for a few years, and though he was very smart, he was no Superman. So it was clear that he couldn't create these institutions in the sense of going there and becoming director of something that had to be made to function within a particular community. I interrogated Nina Kandinsky, the widow of Kandinsky, while she was alive, on that subject, and she confirmed that Kandinsky did nothing of the sort. He remained in Moscow. He received correspondence and samples of work and responses to his own questions, and he provided those with whose work he was charged with commentaries and glossaries and instructions which had bearing both upon aesthetics and how it is to function within an institution. Nevertheless, this activity brought him into contact, of course, with Russian artists, with the entire cultural milieu, and involved him also in many of the issues and controversies that marked this period. The exhibition is particularly interesting with respect to the comparison between Kandinsky on the one hand and the Russian colleagues on the other. As you walk down, we are still on the top ramp, and as you pay attention to the work of Malevich and Popova and Udaltsova, Kliun, Rachenko, Elisitsky, you become aware, as Kandinsky was aware, that this is something very, very different, even from the already changed aspects of Kandinsky's art. To Kandinsky himself, the Russian approach, the approach of his Russian colleagues, seemed exaggerated. It seemed experimental in its radicality. He did not oppose it, but he did not dignify it with full artistic meaning. If you compare such work with his own, you will see that they really became hard-edged, that they took planes, that they superimposed upon each other. They tried to eliminate as much as possible personal idiosyncrasies, personal symbols and individual expressions, and had great faith in the in generally valid forms which they thought would be most able to express new meanings. Kandinsky could never free himself from the assumption that whatever the purpose of art may be, it is rooted in a particular individuality, in a unique individuality, and for that reason remained distant from the work of his Russian colleagues, and for that matter, from the work of Mondrian and the Dutch colleagues, which to him was always something that, as a cultivated and freely thinking person, he did not blindly reject, but he did not feel that this was what interested him or what the objective of his own searches would be. Well, naturally, with this kind of act, there were all sorts of disputes and all sorts of conversations and exchanges about the meaning of art and its purposes. Exchanges that continue to the present day. What is art about? Does it exist for its own sake? Is it art for art? Should it serve an intellectual or social elite as it did in old Russia and everywhere else? Or should it be something that in the hands of politically committed individuals would aim to help progressive political tendencies? Should it be for the people? Should it be utilitarian rather than embellishing? Should it improve life, both by its symbolism and by its application to life situations? These were the discussions which took place, and Kandinsky did not always fare too well by stating his own moderate views. But perhaps even more importantly than this, it was clear for those who knew Russia, knew the political situation, that what I referred to a moment ago as the honeymoon between Bolshevism and modern art was not going to last forever. The handwriting was on the wall. Kandinsky read it, and while he probably could not have foreseen to what degree art would eventually be debased as a mere means of power political purposes, what he saw and what he heard was sufficiently alarming for him to pick himself up with Nina in 1921 and return to Berlin. He went to Berlin and not to France, because for Kandinsky, we have to remember, Germany was really the other country. He was brought up in part with the German language and literature, and Germany was to him a second alternative, always the next alternative to his Russian home. In Berlin, and I'll have to make that very brief, the situation wasn't particularly rosy either. He arrived in a country defeated in a recent war, with galloping inflation, and the works of art that he had hoped to find there, his own, which he left before departing for Russia, could not be gotten to either. They had been lost or dispersed, so that his financial situation was precarious. And furthermore, some of the ideological disputes that he thought he would leave behind him in Russia cropped up in different ways, and he felt fairly unhappy and isolated. As a result, he was glad to see that an earlier contact that he has established with architect Gropius, the new head of the Bauhaus, which was created in 1919, that these contacts began to mature into an offer to become a teacher master at the Bauhaus, an offer which he accepted with pleasure in 1922, when he and Nina settled in the city of Weimar. Well, the Bauhaus, let me remind you, was not a conventional school. Some kind of teaching, of course, was going on, but more important than prepare students to become artists was the underlying theoretical basis, which had a definitive purpose. The purpose was to unify again what had become separate elements in the creative arts. Unify the academic training of an artist and his thinking in creative terms, on the one hand, the fine arts, in other words, with craftsmanship, design, closeness to materials, the level of craftsmanship that tended to become more and more a separate and special discipline. Gropius and his colleagues correctly thought that painting cannot be merely mental or merely material, that the true artist must simultaneously encompass ideological and material dimensions, must know something about materials and media, about surfaces, about the particular properties of the things he works with, and integrate this into the kind of thinking and creating that fine arts was about. And for that purpose, a preliminary course, a four-course, was given at the Bauhaus, one of which Kandinsky chaired and in which he taught. He felt at home in Weimar, partly because he was reunited with some of his friends from the Munich period, and also because he made new friends whose thinking was congenial and interesting to him. As you see this exhibition, you will come upon the Bauhaus names, people who either were there when Kandinsky arrived or arrived subsequently. And you'll see the work by such powerful colorists as Johannes Itten. You will see the sublime and whimsical, marvelously fine and refined work of Paul Klee. You will see Feininger's architectural space visions, Schlemmer, who never removed himself from the human figure, applying this to the dance and to theater. You eventually will see Albers, who developed color theories which had great importance eventually in the United States. Moholy-Nagy, who perhaps more closely than others had developed a dynamic art pointing toward design. Architects like Marcel Breuer, who designed chairs, among them the so-called Vasily chair, because Vasily Kandinsky was the first one to acquire it. And all of this created not a unified style, nothing like the style at the in the Dutch environment of Mondrian and his friends, but it created a searching environment in which new ideals were developed and articulated. And Kandinsky himself was a great articulator, both as teacher and as author. As a teacher, his further concentration upon an objective constructivist art took shape as he stood in the classroom and conveyed to his students the application of geometry to the fine arts. He would speak about the meaning of the dot, an insubstantial thing, ideally without dimension, but in reality something that has at least minimal height, width, and depth, and would speak and explain how this dot, if one placed next to the other, became a line, and how this line had different application in painting depending on whether it is straight or curved, whether it is angular or undulating, and how when you take the line as a whole and continue it across the canvas, it defines a plane which again could be square, rectangular, could be circular, oval, and in each of these instances have a different effect upon the viewer. He did similar things with color. He and his students investigated the effect of different colors, particularly of primary colors, upon our perceptions. And in questionnaires that he has established and dispersed among students and colleagues, he would try to arrive at determinable conclusions as to the attributes and qualities of different primaries. Yellow, to Kandinsky's mind, moved forward. Red was commanding the central plane. Blue receded. And when blue was combined with a circle, this recession became almost celestial and intangible, whereas the yellow combined with a triangle would aggressively move toward the front and establish an entirely different mood. So in these Bauhaus years, during his teaching and in his book, which was the theoretical sister treatise to the spiritual art called Point and Line to Plane, Kandinsky attempted a grammar for the art, something that would be analogous to the Harmonielehre of Arnold Schoenberg, in which he hoped to develop from the more or less geometrical vocabulary that was at his disposal at that time a determinable sounding base in visual terms. A complex painting, a composition for instance, would for Kandinsky be something in which forms and colors would reinforce each other or cancel each other out, strengthen and weaken, advance and recede, and make the whole thing sound as something that has particular meaning, even if this meaning was not easily, perhaps not at all, transferable in verbal terms. The exhibition, and perhaps the most important part of the exhibition, then deals with that portion of Kandinsky's work at the Bauhaus that is the painterly expression of the theories and ideals that we have just discussed. The purpose is a synthesis, a combination of many elements toward a controllable artistic result. Now, the work in Weimar was not always easy and not always rewarding, despite the congeniality of the intellectual environment and despite the friendships that sustained him in Weimar and in Dessau. The reason for this was largely political. The old Goethe town in Weimar was highly suspicious of those strange characters who settled in the Bauhaus and who proposed scaringly new ideas. Even though these ideas were not generally understood, the German middle class in Weimar had an instinct for what is and what could be dangerous to their own values and to their own lifestyles. And they very clearly perceived that what Gropius and his friends were doing was likely to change their lives in a way in which they would resent it. So the pressures for the moment on the local level and on the level simply of Philistinism increased and gradually put the Bauhaus people on the defensive to the point where in 1925 they preferred to remove themselves and seek a more hospitable home. They did this by moving to Dessau, and for a while, indeed, things seemed more hopeful and auspicious. First of all, they were less dependent upon official support. They established themselves as a private corporation. Financially, things began to look up a little bit. Gropius built a Bauhaus building with a central apartment for himself and double apartments for the master teachers of the Bauhaus, so that Klee and Kandinsky actually lived door to door, exchanging in mutually very important notions and coming very close to each other in their work at times. And everything seemed very nice and handsomely arranged for a little while. However, we are now in the years of 1925, and as you know, the influence of the Nazi Party in Germany began to increase in these years and eventually bear directly and most negatively upon the purposes of the Bauhaus. This means that just at a time at which achievements were at their height, and Kandinsky had published his book that I mentioned a moment ago and had passed, incidentally, his 60th birthday, had gained great reputation as a teacher and professor in the Bauhaus school. At that time, the forces against the whole idea began to crystallize in an ominous way, and in the 1930s, the Hitler Party, for reasons that from their point of view are entirely clear, because nothing would be more opposed to their own aims than the idealistic, clear thinking and detached theories of the Bauhaus group, for their own reasons, first threatened the Bauhaus faculty and its functioning, and eventually in 1933 closed it altogether. Kandinsky himself was loath to let go. He was deeply committed to the Bauhaus idea and happy in Germany. He became a German citizen and hoped really for nothing else than to continue the very fruitful work that he was able to proceed on so many levels. But as was the case in Munich, once more, external situations forced their destructive course, and when in 1933 the Bauhaus was finally closed and dissolved, Kandinsky and Nina went to Paris, where they hoped to remain only a few months, hoping against hope that this entire misery would pass and revert again into normal channels. When it didn't, the inevitable consequence was that the 67-year-old artist embarked upon the last phase of his great artistic oeuvre, and that he stayed there to remain for the next 11 years to his death in the Parisian capital. But this is another and a different story, and since it is 11 o'clock now, I must bring this to a conclusion by expressing the hope that when our Parisian exhibition winds itself up and down the ramps, I may have the pleasure of welcoming you here again to tell you the last chapter. Thank you very much.